There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we are joined by the wonderful Ella Al-Shamahi. You might remember Ella from episode 373 of No Such Thing as a Fish when she last appeared. But if you don't remember that, then she is a paleoanthropologist. She's an expert in Neanderthals. She is a National Geographic explorer. She's just an all-round badass. Ella has written a book called The Handshake, A Gripping History, which we talked about last time she was on. But she's also been on loads of TV shows, loads of documentaries. The last one, I think, was called Our Changing Planet, all about the world's most threatened ecosystems. And you can actually still watch that if you go to BBC iPlayer or PBS Video app. Anyway, really hope you enjoy this week's show. Don't forget Club Fish exists, the place where you can get loads of extra content and ad-free episodes. Don't forget there are still one or two tickets, I think, possibly left for our live shows coming up in the Soho Theatre in London, and you can get those by going to nosuchthingsafish.com/Soho. Anyway, that's enough of that. Really hope you enjoy this week's show with Ella, and it's on with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, James Harkin, and Ella Al-Shamahi. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Ella.
American beer was so bad in the early 1900s that the US government sent Alexander Graham Bell's son-in-law on a secret mission to Bavaria to steal German hops.
Wow. Gosh, so much to unpick.
Yeah. Okay, so Alexander Graham Bell's son-in-law, was that an important part of it? Was that what the American government were looking for? Is that the brief?
The really sad thing is David Fairchild is like a hugely celebrated botanist and is described as the food explorer. And yet for our purposes, he's just Alexander Graham Bell's son-in-law. Because to be fair, if he was your father-in-law, that's the end of your identity, right?
But was it maybe this was at the point when there was only two telephones in the country? And so the government would just call him up and say, you got anyone we could use?
Yeah. So you think when he invented two telephones, Alexander Graham Bell, he gave one to the government and kept one himself.
Yeah.
No one else needs one, it's fine.
And it became like the bat phone. It was any time they were needed for anything.
Bell phone.
Yeah, the bell
phone. I'm loving the facts today, guys.
So yeah, what's this guy, Fairchild?
So, all right, so David Fairchild, so he's a food explorer, and I think he's absolutely fascinating because explorers usually go around the planet, let's be honest, discovering stuff, but also pillaging a lot and what have you, and like stealing artifacts and whatever takes your fancy. But this guy did it with plants, with botany, which is, in my mind, is just like the loveliest thing to go around the planet stealing. Because all he's doing is, he's basically turned around at the beginning of the 1900s going, and the end of the 1800s going, America is a country clearly on the rise, but our agriculture is bad, our food is bad, like our industries as related to, as you know, as they relate to plants are just bad. So I'm going to go off to 50 odd countries and just collect samples, send seeds back, send saplings back, that kind of thing. And because it's plants, I just can't get mad at him. Because I'm just like, you were just helping to feed your people and build industry.
Could we get him cancelled because he was like stealing from the farmers?
Well, are you trying to get him cancelled?
I'm doing my best. I do this on this podcast. Whoever we have on, I try.
Don't ever mention anyone you like on this show. James will find a way to destroy.
Do not do this to me, because I've decided that he's like the one explorer that I really have nothing bad to say about. I'm like, oh, fair enough. You're trying to feed your people. He did give the Americans broccoli and kale. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I love those two things.
It's interesting how limited American food was. Yeah. I didn't really appreciate that before the 1890s, when he really got cracking. They had occasional introductions, like in the World's Fair in 1876, which was effectively America's 100th birthday. They got the banana. That was good. That was a big advance.
Also, can we just take a second to talk about World Fairs? Aren't they just the best thing ever?
Oh, yeah.
Just this world where you were like, oh, let's just do a World Fair. And it actually was legit. Like, everyone was like, oh, crap, that's new. What is that? It's yellow and it's bendy. That's amazing.
When did we last have one?
I went to one in Dubai this year.
Oh, yes. Okay, so this year.
Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah, they had one.
Well, they did one during COVID. And obviously no one could go. And then when I went, everything was closed. So you couldn't even get an Uber. Everyone had gone home. Because that's what it is. They build them, these sort of huge things, don't they? And all the different countries have their different stalls where they're saying, in Uzbekistan, we make amazing bananas or whatever. And then 2 years later, they all go home and that's it. But
they only do it with countries that are on the rise, right? Right.
Yeah,
America wouldn't do a world fair anymore. We are the world. Like, why would we do a world fair?
There was the big one in America. Carl Sagan went to as a kid, so Sagan would be in his 80s if he was still alive, or 90. So, you know, within that.
The one in Dubai, just to say this, is quite interesting, because each country made their own sort of building. And they were all kind of shaped with Uzbekistani design or Azerbaijani design or whatever. Mm. And now they're changing it and they're turning it into flats, the whole place.
Oh, wow.
And they're going to make it so you can live in this area. But it means that all these buildings are just these incredible designs that are made from the best architects in the world.
It sounds like you're selling Dubai instead of cancelling Dubai, which I thought you were the canceller.
Visit Dubai.
You can't get an Uber there. There's no shops there or anything. Yeah, so I wouldn't want to live there.
That's the bad side of Dubai. Guys, of all the bad crap that
famously
you can...
there are no shops in Dubai. Someone emailed in, and I'm going to butcher their fact now and also not credit them, but it's because I didn't think we're going to end up talking about world fairs. It was a few years ago, the Brazilian delegation turned their entire thing into a trampoline.
What?
It was something like a 4,000 square foot trampoline, the Brazilian bit of the world.
Was it to sell rubber?
I don't think it was. I don't even think it was. I think it was just saying, look, everyone else has got good stuff here. Well, you've got a big old trampoline, so just come along, have a bounce, enjoy yourself.
They had a big project that at the last minute got taken away. Right, and they went, we got? What have we got?
Why are we talking about the World Fair?
I'm sorry, I got distracted.
Yeah, this is what happens when Ella is around.
Because during the World Fair, the banana was introduced to America. Food introduction.
By Fairchild or someone else?
That was like a sporadic thing. But then when he really got going, he was privately funded as well.
Yes.
By Barbour Lathrop.
Yes. A wonderfully gay, fabulous figure, basically, who's just this incredible philanthropist.
Squillionaire, just looking for something to fund.
And they bumped into each other on a boat, didn't they? And he just went, I'll fund this trip with you trying to steal avocados. Yeah, why not? This sounds great.
Can I just say, as an explorer with National Geographic, that is our dream. That we if you think I'm kidding, you do not know like my friend group, in the sense that we are like, we literally just sit there constantly going, right, how do we get this kind of thing from philanthropy? And every so often it works out. So like, I've got friends that like they're like the smart friend of the philanthropist, who is like some billionaire or millionaire. Yeah.
They're like their sugar mama, dadda, whatever.
Have I ever told you the story of Nat Geo? Somebody walks up to me. It's a really old guy, bless him. First time I've ever been at National Geographic. And he looks at me and goes, I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm not an oil man, but I've got money and I want to give you some. I saw that money in my account. An expedition was part funded by it.
Wow. So as simple as that. Okay, so it does happen. Yeah. That's amazing. So Fairchild, I agree. I think reading about him, he seems like an extraordinary guy. I'm surprised I'd never heard of him, for example. But if you're in America and you're eating, say, like peaches or nectarines or avocados or mangoes, most likely the one that you're eating right now, someone's bound to be eating one right now as they listen, shares genes from the ones that Fairchild introduced to the country.
That is quite
all those years ago. What a sort of footprint he's left in the country. Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah.
Send us your photos if you're eating eating a mango now
right now in
America
or an avocado,
some quinoa.
Yeah, did he bring in quinoa?
Yep. Podcast@qi.com.
We want to see mangosteens.
The mangosteen. Yeah. Oh, great! Let's talk about this. This is great.
Go on. What is the mangosteen?
It's a fruit that he introduced and that never took off. Because he introduced thousands, and they didn't all take off.
Still buy mangosteens, though, can't you?
Think so. Yeah, they just never exploded.
Wait, I had never heard of the mangosteen before.
Really?
Yeah.
The guy who wrote the book on David Fairchild is Dan Stone, who's a friend of mine. And apparently while he was writing this book, everybody would just send him really exotic fruit for the whole time he was writing the book, because they were like, this is good for you, no?
Yeah.
He's like, sure.
Yeah, the book's called The Food Explorer, by the way. I think it's fair to say that every bit of research I have is from David Stone. So, yeah, well done, mate.
So, tell us about mangosteens, Andy.
Well, as far as I can tell, Dan and I have never heard of them before, and you two are like having them for breakfast every day. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're the size of a fist, roughly, and they're like a lychee.
Brilliant.
But the problem is, they're not great for farming. And what he was doing, Fairchild, you have to persuade the farmers to grow the things and the public to buy them. Mm. That's two jobs to carry out, basically. Yeah. And he couldn't persuade either, apparently, either side of the equation, because they're really hard. They bruise worse than peaches, and they're just a nightmare to transport, and they go off really quickly. But he said they were the queen of fruits.
They were his favourite.
Really? I know.
And he kept trying to make them happen, like Fetch in Mean Girls. Kept trying to make it happen, and no one was picking up on it. And so all these things he brought into the country, but the one of which you headlined your fact with is very interesting, because it was the beer hops.
Yeah.
And you'd think you'd just go into a country, grab some fruit and leave the country, but no, people were so protective. They would have, you know, boys sleeping with the hops at night to make sure no one would see
it. Security, that's the thing.
So he'd come in and integrate himself with the communities. He would sort of become friends.
So this particular hop, so this is, I think, the Semmes hop, he basically started talking about Semmes, the guy that came up with it, who was dead at this point. And he offered the son of Semmes, basically, he said, look, I'm really scared that in a few generations, people aren't going to know about your dad, blah, blah, blah. So he was like, why don't you build a plaque? I will pay for it. So he put money down. So impressive US diplomacy here. Mm-hmm. And they made such a song and dance about it. Everybody was really happy. The whole, everybody in the town was happy about it. And then apparently somebody at night knocks on his door when it's raining and goes, Do you want some cuttings?
Wow.
And apparently he has to really restrain himself to not be like, yes, this is exactly why I did all this and have been manipulating you guys for weeks. And he was like, yeah, okay. And he goes, I can't do this publicly. I have to do it quietly, but I'll send 100 cuttings to the next station down the line.
Oh, not even handing them over now.
No. It was proper espionage.
That's amazing.
It's hilarious. But also to think of all the espionage that the US government has ever done, I just can't object to this one.
Yeah. And that's why American beer now is so delicious, isn't it? I mean, how bad must it have been before?
So here's the crazy thing. Apparently during Prohibition, all his hops were uprooted. So all the Semmes hops that Fairchild...
Oh, really?
They were all uprooted during the...
I read that. Basically, when Prohibition came in, all the breweries closed down. And then when they reopened, there was a few more big ones, and they decided to sell what they knew would sell, because they weren't sure anyone would buy any beer anymore. And so they went with the really safe stuff, which was the light beers and the mass-produced stuff.
Okay, now can you explain Hershey's?
Hershey's?
It tastes like sick.
Yeah, tastes like sick. To British people.
Or, you know, it contains some chemicals which happen to also taste like sick.
I love how people have gone around tasting sick. They haven't. They really haven't. That's not how they
If you're eating a Hershey's bar right now, please send a photo.
Or if you're being sick.
Yeah.
If you're, you know.
Either way.
Oh, yes, that one.
Yeah. Podcast@qi.com.
Do they have your address? Because I feel like if they have your address, they could send the mangosteens and the sick, etc. to the address.
We've just moved offices, and the reason being that the old office was just full of sick and mangosteens.
It's inundated.
But everyone's tasted sick if they've ever been sick.
True.
You know.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You just taste it in reverse, don't you? Sorry to, I mean, to, you know, to lower the tone.
That's nasty.
Yeah. But that's how we know what American chocolate tastes like.
Yeah.
Great.
Good thinking.
Did you guys hear about the cherry blossom trees in DC and how he's responsible for all of them, basically? So, I mean, we have them now in London quite a lot. Yeah. They're very kind of ornamental and very beautiful. But he introduced them from Japan, and then it became all the rage, and people were like queuing up to see him and Alexander Graham Bell's daughter's residence.
It was at their house, wasn't it? He put it to his... Yeah. Oh.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And then, basically, Washington, D.C. was not the beautiful metropolis it now is. back then, it was kind of ugly. And he started saying, well, maybe we should just plant some cherry blossom trees around here, and that would be kind of beautiful. And then the First Lady heard of this, and before you know it, the Japanese, who at this point they're not particularly like chummy with, they're like, okay, this could be a symbol of friendship. If you give us 300 cherry blossom trees, we can plant them in DC. And the Japanese got carried away, ended up shipping 2,000. But they opened the crates, I think it was in Seattle, and went, oh crap, they were diseased. They were absolutely infested with invasive species. So then they had to publicly burn the symbol of friendship between Japan and the US.
Yeah.
And it was like on the front page of the New York
Times. And the thing I read was it was from orders of the president, which feels like he should have been busier than having to make executive decisions about agricultural imports.
Although it was his decision, wasn't it? Because it was him and the First Lady who kind of made the decision to bring it over, wasn't it? Mm.
Wow.
But the Japanese were like, are bad, and so it was all fine. They sent more over, and then they are now.
And as a result, US-Japanese relations stayed very harmonious, didn't they?
Yeah.
Good.
It was interesting, because the ones that they sent over the second time, they had to make sure that they were really not infested. So they raised the trees in virgin soil, so the soil was brand new, and they'd never been anywhere else. They wraps the roots in damp moss to stop
any... That's a lot
any...
of work for a friendship, man.
Yeah. That's great.
It's great. And they fumigated it twice, once to asphyxiate the insects and then once just in case. but yeah, and the reason that they did this is because this guy, Fairchild, had a nemesis called Charles Marlatt, didn't he?
Yep.
This is an amazing story. So Charles Marlatt was in charge of the FDA, sort of anti-insect part of the FDA. Mm. But they were boyhood friends. And actually, Marlatt was Fairchild's best man at his wedding. but then they fell out because Fairchild basically got a load of easy jobs through his friends and family, a bit of nepotism and stuff. And Marlatt had to work hard for his job. And so they really fell out. And Marlatt, basically, whenever Fairchild brought in any new species, he would be like, there's insects on that. Get rid of it. Burn it. Do it now. And so they really, really fell out.
I have to defend the entomologist here, even though I loved Ed Fairchild. So it's worth saying that, like, Fairchild, he did get a lot of fame, but a lot of that was off his own back. But then, yeah, sure, he married into, like, this really prominent family and became really big with National Geographic. Mm. But today, we would actually side with the entomologist.
Yeah.
Like, scientifically, he's the sound one.
Yeah,
not the botanist just being like, well, let's just hope it's going to be fine when we bring all these parts from all over the world.
Yeah, definitely.
It was dangerous. Yeah.
I read this amazing story that he wanted to send 1,000 mangoes back to America, but he put them on a boat and they were too heavy. and so he solved it by getting a load of local children to eat them all.
What?
Because all he needed were the stones.
Brilliant.
He didn't need the mangoes themselves.
Oh,
so
brilliant.
He just got all the kids and said, free mangoes, as many as you can eat. They all went, nom, 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 nom.
US diplomacy. There we go. That's another...
Yeah.
That's
sorry. I thought you were going to say something really clever, like he only needed to ship the children there.
And then they'd poo them out.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was thinking, God, those children are brave, like pooing out a mango stone. That's not funny.
Yeah.
And
then, no. Children famously a bit more heavy than a mango as well. So weight was your issue.
I know. I'm sorry.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Okay, it's time for fact number two, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that at one stage of the 17th century, every woman living on the Yemeni island of Socotra was called Maria.
Was it? Okay. Okay.
How many women were on the island?
Well, I don't know, but it wasn't completely insignificant. It's a big island, right? It's about the size of what, Mallorca?
Long
You've
Island.
Been there,
it's big.
Haven't you?
Long Island,
Is it that they were hosting a Sound of Music reality show?
In the 17th century?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I feel like that's a real Yemeni vibe. It's like the tribesmen and the Sound of Music.
Well, I don't know exactly how many people live there. How many people would you say live there now? It's in the 10,000.
I think it's about 40,000.
40,000, yeah. Yeah. It would have been less then. But basically, it was a Christian island. Mm. By tradition, it was St. Thomas who was shipwrecked there in the year 52 AD. Okay. And he supposedly brought in Christianity. But definitely, the Greeks brought it in the 4th century. That definitely happened. And Marco Polo wrote about it in the 13th century that there were Christians there. And in the 17th century, there was a guy called Padre Vincenzo. And he visited Socotra. And he found that they were still Christian ostensibly, but they kind of moved to other beliefs, because Socotra is a place that's very difficult to get to, especially at certain times of year. You can't really get there at all.
The monsoon
of the winds.
Is, yeah. Good luck.
And so because they were isolated from the rest of the world, they kind of had this new version of Christianity. So a lot of them were called Maria. There were still a lot of churches, but for instance, they used to do sacrifices to the moon and a few different things.
Why not keep some of your old beliefs in? Just spice it all up a bit. What year was that again?
It was in the mid 17th century.
Why were they called Maria?
Because Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Oh.
Yeah.
That must have been confusing.
Oh, yeah.
No, because they don't.
Have you been there? Have you been there?
Yeah, so I've been to Socotra. I can verify that it's very difficult to get there.
Have you met a Maria?
I have not met a Maria, because weirdly, there's no Christians left on the island.
No.
Whoa.
Why is that?
Someone said, Maria, come over here.
No, they're all Muslims now. So I went there kind of 2018, I think, or 2019. And we had three options to get there. Either we fly in via mainland Yemen, but the airport we were flying into was an Al-Qaeda stronghold. So decided maybe that's not the best way of getting in. And then the other route was via kind of almost like a private jet via the Emirates, the place that you like. but they were only giving us verbal permission, not written permission.
Right.
And then the third option was to get on a cement cargo ship from Oman and sail through pirate waters. And the ship was like infested with cockroaches, like completely infested. And it had like the toilet was like a basket on the side of the ship, like attached with rope.
Is this the route you went?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
No pirates.
We luckily didn't have the, we
just,
you know,
the cockroaches.
Yeah, the Swede in the group had his wits about him. Let me tell you that every time a ship went past, he was like, just very nervous.
But yeah, so it's really hard to get to, and that's the thing, right? But then that's good news for other things. So it means that they have amazing biodiversity there, and
you've seen the trees there.
They look incredible. Yeah. I mean, the dragon blood tree. I know that's the most famous, really. Yeah. That's the sort of like the headline tree out there, but they do look beautiful.
It is amazing.
They're described, if you'd want to picture it, they're described as sort of looking like umbrellas, but a lot of them look like umbrellas with a high wind where, you know, when your umbrella flips inside out, because you see the stems coming up, and they're known for the fact that if the sap comes out, it's red sap, hence the kind of dragon blood thing. And they've been exporting that for years, and it's been used for all sorts of like nail polish and medicines and so on.
Smearing gladiators.
Really?
Gladiators supposedly had a bit of it smeared on them as decoration and a bit as disinfectant. But the thing is that the tree, I think it only exists there now, but pollen has been found all around the Mediterranean. As in fossilized, really? Or archaeologists have found pollen of it around the Med. Mm. So this is what the Med used to look like. There used to be these trees much more commonly.
So the dragon's blood tree, there's different species of dragon's blood. And there are still what we call in biology relic populations. So kind of populations that are on their last leg in Socotra. But there's different species of dragon's blood in the Canary Islands. There's another species in Oman, and kind of a remote part of Oman. And it looks like the Dragon's Blood tree was like a really dominant tree,
right,
in the whole of the kind of that old world. It's kind of old school. It should kind of really be on its out, and it is.
Well, it is, right. They're saying possibly in the next 80 years,
yeah.
if we're not careful, it's going to be an extinct species of tree.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting how it survives, because most trees obviously get their water through the roots under the ground. Mm-hmm. But this tree has worked out a way. I don't know if that's a language you use about trees, but it's got the ability to take in the moisture of the clouds that are going above it. So it can pull from above as well as below, which is pretty amazing.
It injects much more water into the soil from the air than it gets in rainfall, because sometimes it's foggy and cloudy and it sort of sucks all that. It's called horizontal precipitation capture, which is as it sounds. But they've got, I think, 92 different plant species which live in the undergrowth. A few surveys have found that. And seven of them are only found living in the undergrowth of the Dragon's Blood tree.
That's mad.
And it's so cool.
I suppose that would make it an umbrella species. And it looks like an umbrella.
No.
I'll tell you what, National Geographic, they're going wild for that.
Kills. Yeah.
I mean, when you turn up there, I'm not going to lie, you're like, what is this place? It looks... There's so few places on Earth where you look at them and you go, oh, that looks really alien. Like, that's a really unusual landscape. And Socotra is definitely that. Like, these canyons, like Grand Canyon, almost, obviously not that scale, but with these dragon blood trees and other trees as well, you know, and giant snails and a bunch of stuff that you're just like, what is this?
Well, Ella, can I ask you, as the only one who's been there...
Yeah.
Did it seem to you at all like the atmosphere of the planet Pandora in the global mega hit Avatar films?
Okay. Actually, this is a good crowd to ask this to, because I've heard that as well, that was an inspiration somewhere. And I wondered if we knew what the source of that was, because I could... Here's the thing. Yeah. The thing with Socotra is, if you speak to people that are really in the know, so people, the kind of off-the-beat travellers, people that are very interested in kind of biology, that kind of thing, they all know Socotra. It's like this hidden secret that actually everybody in a certain industry knows about. It's, you know, and it's on people's dream. I've met very rich people that are desperate for me to take them to Socotra, and I'm like, sure, once I've dealt with the pirate situation, I will get you and your very rich
queue of wizened Texans just waiting to be.
But yeah, I wondered about that, because I was like, I can see that, but I just wonder what the source is, because I just, being that we care about facts here, guys, right? Right? Sure. I need more.
Well, there's one thing we care about more than facts, and that's the continued success of the Way of Water franchise. never mind.
Just on the Christianity in Yemen in the 17th century, this was what Padre Vincenzo was talking about. A few weird things that they did. They had a priest called an Adambo who was elected by the people and changed every single year. It's like almost like an archbishop of the island, but democratic. That's quite cool, isn't it?
Let me tell you about modern day Yemen.
And the other thing is, in the churches, they had like a what would you call it? Like an altar, and every day they would smear it with butter.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, that does sound great. Kind of...
What reason?
Do they slide along it? Or...
Yeah.
Because that would be a great way of starting a service, wouldn't it? Yeah. You know, whoosh, I'm here.
Or is it sort of like you're going up for your body of Christ? Would you like some butter?
I love how this is just the fantasies that these two have. Yeah. That's what would take those two heathens back to church.
I've got a general Yemen fact.
Oh, yeah.
Go.
Yemen, I think, used to be a British... colony? Protectorate?
That's the south safe to say about anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
The British were involved in something.
Well, you know, yeah. During that era, the port of Aden, which was, and I think even after the rest of Yemen might have gained independence, Aden maintained a kind of special status. Basically, Aden was in a pretty constant state of emergency. Things were so dicey there that British citizens living there were issued pretty much as standard with revolvers in case of assassination attempts on them. Imagine that. Imagine just moving to somewhere and being fitted with a revolver.
Yeah, Yemen's an interesting place. Like so there was a revolution, and obviously now there's a war. And there was like a protest, and outside the protest it says no bazookas. So you're allowed to
bring
other weapons, just no bazookas. We're drawing the line of bazookas. Oh, and landmines. They were like, no bazookas and no hand grenades.
Oh my god,
that's so funny. Because we just have protests here, and if you brought like
a whistle
or a luggage tag, they kind of ship you away to prison.
No. But in defense of my parents' homeland, I will say have you seen pictures of mainland Yemen and the island of Scotland? It's the most stunning place. And I know I'm biased, but it is absolutely epically beautiful.
I saw a photo of a place. I wonder if you've seen it in person. You've been there quite a few times, right? It's described as the Manhattan of the desert.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds incredible. That was Freya Stark, explorer, who called it that in the 1930s. But this is a 16th century walled city that was the first ever city of skyscrapers. They went 7 floors high and the buildings were made of mud. It was just a metropolis.
Yeah, and higher, actually.
And there's still, obviously, there's been renovations and so on. But is there anything original?
Oh, it's all there. So it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Again, so Socotra is also a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And it's basically buildings 10, 11, whatever stories high. The really cute thing is that some of those houses have bridges.
Yeah.
On the top of the houses, nice. Because people can't be bothered to go all the way downstairs because they don't have elevators. They're like,
right,
historic buildings, right? So they, instead of going all the way downstairs to go visit the neighbors, they just go to the top, which they call the Jubba, and they just leg it along these little bridges.
And it's still, but the thing is, it's so old and it's still inhabited. That's the amazing.
Oh no, it's inhabited. It's completely so inhabited. Yeah. It's a lived-in World Heritage Site. It's great. I mean, when you turn up there, you're like, are you kidding? Wow. So bazookas and pistols, yes, but also heritage.
It was the
go visit, guys.
It was the only place you could get coffee from for 200 years until one of these people who stole plants went in.
Your heroes,
suddenly,
Ella.
I don't like them.
Went in, nicked all the coffee, and if Mocha, which is the place where the coffee was exported from, if they still had the monopoly on coffee, there would be enough money for everyone in Yemen to get a payment of $16,000 per year on top of anything else they earned.
Are you kidding me?
And that would be 8 times higher than the actual average salary of a person from Yemen.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Oh, man, that's depressing.
Just one more thing on Marys.
Oh, yeah.
At the end of the 18th century, 24% of women in England were called Mary.
The Socotra of the North, they called it.
And in Vexin, which is in France, just northwest of Paris, in 1740, 68.4% of women were called Mary.
What?
Or Marie, it would be, of course.
Do any of you have Marias in your families?
I have a cousin.
Yeah, Rosemary is my auntie. Yeah. So there's... Yeah, I wonder if it's that, if it's the double barrel first name.
Well, in France, that's what happened. Yeah. So around that time, around the 18th century, they started doing the double names. So you could have Marie-Claire or Marie whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, so they started... Almost everyone was called Marie something.
Oh.
In 1379, 33% of the male population of Sheffield were called John. Oh. And 22% of the women were called Alice.
John and Alice have invited us round. Be more specific!
That's us! Okay, it is time for fact number 3, and that is Andy.
My fact is that during the Second World War, the making of Spitfires was so secret that one married couple didn't know they were both working on it.
Was that John and Alice?
It was John and Alice.
That's cool. So
it's so weird.
I wonder if they both thought that the other was having an affair.
I know. Imagine them going to work in the morning. Like, off to work. Yeah, me too.
Okay.
See you later.
I'm going in this direction.
I'll just pop back to the house for a minute.
But was there someone at work whose job it was to keep them apart as well? A nightmare life of they're coming to the canteen at the same time. Hey, why don't you come in?
It's such a weird fact.
How did they find out? So
they
many
found
questions.
Out decades later. That's the crazy thing. So this is like,
was
this
that
is
the only secret thing they were working on? I have so many questions. Was that the only secret thing they were working on?
I think they were both working in this specific factory. So
the same factory, even.
Yeah, it was the same factory. Yeah, yeah. But
they might be idiots, guys.
It's possible. Basically, for anyone who doesn't know, we're talking about the Spitfire, the Supermarine Spitfire's legendary plane of the Second World War. You know, big thing in Britain, big kind of national myth item in Britain, the Spitfire. And there was a factory in Southampton which made, I think, most of the Spitfires. And it was bombed in 1940 by the Luftwaffe, and it was not just bombed, it was flattened, and this was a disaster. And they needed to work out how to, you know, keep Spitfire production going, but keep it safe from bombing raids. And what they did was they said, well, we'll make it in secret, and not only that, we'll divide all the factories into, you know, lots of different tiny micro factories around the place, which are all hidden. So they used all sorts of little offices or garages, a laundry, an old glove factory. They just divided, it was amazing, they just divided it up. And lots of them were in Salisbury and Reading and Trowbridge and just like all over the place, basically. And this came out decades after the war that this is how it had been done, basically. And there was an engineer who worked on them called Norman Parker. And he said in 2021, he was interviewed about it. He was about 95 at the time that he was talking about this. He said, "We had one case. There was a couple at a dinner party in the 1970s. And over the dinner table, the wife said, 'Oh, I was building Spitfires in Salisbury during the war.' And the husband said, 'No, you weren't. I was.'" And they had both been working in the same factory and they didn't know it.
It could be a false memory, couldn't it? I guess.
I think this is a really bad marriage, guys.
Yeah.
I've got...
Well, there are a number of things it could have been, but basically... Yeah.
I reckon I have things with my siblings that we talk about when we were really, really young, and we all think that we were the one who did a certain thing.
Oh, right.
Do you know what I mean?
You're throwing... you're throwing shade on the... I'm not saying that's true,
but I'm just saying, like, I remember, like, I was... You know, my brother was locked in a toilet in France when we went to a restaurant once and we had to get him out, and then he thinks it was my sister who was that. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. It's like... Mm.
Yeah.
Weird, eh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or it could be that they're both... That they're telling the truth and it's a real thing.
Oh my god.
Do we know what they worked on specifically?
Well, I think that's the other thing. Production was divvied up in lots of ways. So it might have been by same factory. It was a factory, it was at different sites, or it was they probably weren't in the same room.
He could have been making the leather chairs for what could be used for a car but was for a plane. And as in like, it's,
sure, yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's what I mean, to the level of what were they making.
Exactly,
the Spitfire.
And people were
plausible for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
I think they sort
and
of dug into
very
it.
Very secretive.
And people were very secretive. Or you might know in a couple, I'm working on something that's secret and I can't really tell you what it's about. And they're both in war work. And the thing is about aviation, during the Second World War, 65% of the aviation workforce were women, because most of them were.
So statistically, she's more likely to be correct.
I think they're both correct.
So she's told this guy at the dinner table, he's gone, "Wow, what an amazing life. What did you do?" Spitfires as well.
So anyway, the Spitfire.
Brilliant. Spitfire is amazing.
So are you into the Spitfire?
Yeah.
Because how do I put this politely? The people that talk about Spitfires a lot tend to be a few years older than you.
Thank you. That's actually a compliment, guys. I don't know if you heard. That was. I'm young seeming for a guy as interested in Spitfires.
My teacher at school when I was a kid,
right,
who was an older guy, was really into Spitfires.
I think, actually, Ella, you'll find the more that you meet Andy and talk to him...
He's an old man.
Well, a lot of the things he's interested in, you would expect older men to be interested in. Is that fair to say?
I think it's not unfair. Yeah. I'm not deeply into them, but I am interested in logistics, planning.
So for those who can't see this, he might be shaking a little bit as he said, I'm not really, really into it, but...
I'm trembling with joy. Yeah. I can't I had a look at, just, you know, we check what we've talked about before in this podcast. I had a look. I can't believe you guys have stopped me for 9 years from ever mentioning the Spitfire on this show. We've never mentioned it.
Well done, guys. High five the rest of you.
Great plane.
Incredible plane. And also, what a group effort of the UK during wartime to make this plane built to the numbers that it was built at. Basically, I was reading an article saying that it was effectively like one of the early Kickstarters where people funded, whole communities would go around funding single planes. And they, as a result, got to name the plane. So lots of the planes flying that were in the war had names like Dorothy of Great Britain and Empire. And that was funded entirely by women called Dorothy. So
it's so yes, it's so funny.
Where was the Maria plane?
Yeah, but in fairness, 70% of women were called Dorothy.
There was the dogfighter as well. There was that was the Kennel Club.
Oh right, it wasn't people who did dogfighting.
No,
people in the back of the pub.
But check this out. This is the most incredible one. There was one that was POWs of Oflag. This is a prison camp in Germany that were captured officers who donated their month's pay through the Red Cross. Then that went into the building of a plane. So they were in prison.
Whoa.
And they were funding the plane.
That's
the
war.
I read about that, and they had to send letters back saying, "I want to give my money to this crowdfunding," right?
Yeah.
But they had to do it in code. So because you couldn't send a message that the Germans would be able to read saying, "Please put all my money into Spitfires," otherwise they're just going to accidentally lose it, aren't they? So
yeah, exactly.
It's amazing.
That was a really nice thing, this crowdfunding effort, which I'd not heard of.
What would they have called it back then, though? It wouldn't have been crowdfunding.
They were called Spitfire funds. And the planes were kind of arbitrarily priced. They said £5,000 will buy a Spitfire, which was not actually a true figure, but it sort of was a peg for people.
But also that thing of charities these days will say £2 will buy a meal for one thing.
Yeah, it was like sixpence will buy a rivet.
Exactly.
And £2,000 will get you a wing.
No.
So you could see what you were buying.
It raised a lot of money. It was nearly given a much less sexy name than the Spitfire. Okay. Spitfire's quite a swashbuckling name. Other contenders included Scarab, Shrike, which is quite good because that's a bird that impales its prey. You know, it's quite sort of... but I looked up the complete list of supermarine aircraft, and there were many bad options that the Spitfire could have been called. There was the supermarine commercial amphibian.
Wow.
The supermarine sea urchin. Uh-huh. Supermarine spiteful.
Sure.
Quite good. Supermarine seagull. Supermarine sea otter.
And no,
they're all real. And the supermarine baby.
Oh. No.
Yeah, I know.
In a brainstorm, sometimes there are bad ideas.
Unleash the babies. Yeah, yeah. But they mostly began with S, and they were mostly seaplanes. That's what they started out as. The firm started out making seaplanes, and so...
I love seaplanes.
Yeah, they're cool.
Mm.
Imagine they're a plane where you can just land anywhere.
Mm.
As long as there's a body of water, you just land.
So not on land.
Yeah, well, no.
I'm sorry.
Dan suddenly brings the facts.
Oh, you get special life jackets in case you land on land.
Yeah, exactly.
These supermarine Spitfires, when they were taxiing, so just kind of driving around the airport, they quite often sort of not overturn but get really wobbly. Mm. And so what would happen is someone would often sit on the tail of the plane to keep them steady. And it was often a woman who did this, and there was a particular woman called Margaret Horton who did this in 1943 at RAF Heibaldstow. And she was sat on the back, and the guy was a little bit anxious to get in the air and forgot to get her off the tail.
No.
So started taking off while she was sitting on the tail of the Spitfire. And he radioed down to traffic control saying, there's something wrong with this plane. It's kind of really heavy. And so they talked
just hanging on.
Yeah. So they talked him down. But they never told him that there was a woman on the back.
Oh, no way.
Well, because as soon as they tell him, he's going to be
Right?
So true.
So they're like, oh, yeah, there's obviously a problem with a wing. We'll just talk you down on how to get down. And so he never knew until he landed that this woman was
bloody
there.
Bloody hell.
And she survived.
She survived, yeah.
She survived. There's a museum called Tagmir Military Aviation Museum. And when you go to it, there's a model that they've made. So you can see a model of a Spitfire taking off with this woman. A little plasticine woman or whatever the material is holding on to the tail wing.
So funny.
It's so brilliant.
God. Should we say why it was so good? I guess
I'm like intrigued. So apparently all the pilots loved it, but I'm like, what? Why? Yeah. Why did they all love it?
Well, it was really nimble. It turned very, very fast, and also the other thing about it was it flew very, very fast. Partly because, okay, this is quite niche. If you guys want to tease me when I say this bit, I don't mind.
Okay,
right. But basically, it had flush riveting, which is a good. Okay, ooh. Talk amongst yourselves. Dear listener, so it's metal skin, very, very cool. But if you had lumpy rivets all over it, which most planes did before that, it drags the plane back a bit. Whereas if you sink these little countersunk rivets, so you sort of it's exactly level with the surface of the plane, then the airflow is very efficient and you get a much faster plane.
Clever.
And they did some experiments on early Spitfires. They replicated what it would be like if it had external rivets by gluing split peas onto the spots where the rivets were all over the plane and then flying it, doing a speed test basically. And it was about 22 miles an hour slower. It was a fair chunk slower,
which
would have had a serious effect if you were in a combat situation, and you know.
Could you have stopped the enemy by going in and putting peas on his plane?
Definitely. That was a big part. That was a big part of the early SAS job.
I used to do that, and so did my wife.
So that fact would be even more impressive if I knew what a rivet was.
Well, you've got to retain some mystery, I'm afraid.
That's still under the Secrets Act, actually.
What the hell's a rivet?
A kind of screw.
It's like a big old screw.
It joins the bits of the plane to the other bits
I'm
of the plane.
Googling rivet.
That's so funny.
You know the word riveting? It's got nothing to do with what a rivet is.
Hold on, rivet. She's Googling.
I know, it's because it holds you together.
It holds you in. It holds you in place. Yeah, you're right.
This is it's a kind of screw. Great.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Message in if you didn't know what a rivet was.
I can And if you like, I can repeat that fact for you now, Ella, and it'll be even more exciting this time round.
Should we move on? Or?
Yeah, I'll just quickly mention it.
I feel like we've got enough.
I haven't read a tenth of my stuff out. I haven't told you about the supermarine walrus.
Just out of interest, like, what are your subjects that they won't let you normally talk about? I just need to know, like, how valid.
It's mostly Second World War logistics.
Yeah. We end up letting him do it because he does crowbar it in somehow into any old facts.
So here's a question for you. Do you follow current war strategy and logistics? Like, I've got a whole bunch of male friends who are so into the logistics of the Ukrainian war that it's gone beyond anything that I think is normal.
You'd have to ask my wife what's normal in terms of what...
it's past and present.
I think logistics is interesting. As the, like, and I'm blushing now, but actually, I'm not ashamed.
This is interesting. Needs to go on your tombstone.
We can't all be bloody explorers, you know, on cool cement ships. I'm going to stay on the cement ship. Thank you. I don't want to see Socotra.
Would you look at the rivets on Andy's tombstone?
Oh my god! We've been so mean. Some people need to be in logistics. Just
well, actually, James is right. We're not actually out of time, but we should move on.
Can I tell you one more? Like a sort of Spitfire here. He actually wrote a book partly about the Spitfire. Yeah. Douglas Bader.
Yeah,
Now, he was a really famous pilot. Partly because I think it was in. I don't know if it was an accident.
Well, he famously had no legs.
He had no legs, right. But he lost
both his legs during missions. Flying
accident. Flying incidents, and he became a Spitfire ace nonetheless. In the Second World War, he was shot down over France. And he ejected, so he survived, but he lost one of his prosthetic legs in the course of being shot down. Well, no, he was treated with a lot of respect by the Germans who captured him because there were rules about that. And he was in a prisoner of war camp. And Goering, who was the head of the Luftwaffe, gave special permission for an artificial leg, a spare leg, to be parachuted into his prisoner of war camp.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
I think what happened was, though, he kept trying to escape, and so they confiscated his prosthetic in the end.
They did. Yeah. That was before the relationship soured, I guess. Yeah. And that was called Operation Leg.
Nice.
Where do they come up with their names?
There's one other hero we should mention, which is Lady Houston. Houston's sort of the reason that the Spitfire became the Spitfire during the war. She was a suffragette, political activist. She also was one of the richest women in the UK, if not the richest at one point. And she was someone who kept helping out with war efforts. She was always donating things.
I think the war people didn't like her very much, right? Because
that's right.
She kept saying that they weren't giving enough money to the war effort, they weren't given enough equipment, all that kind of stuff, and she would go around with placards saying give them more guns kind of thing, and they got really annoyed. But she did like get a lot of money together, and I think, are you going to say that she helped to pay for the design of the Spitfire?
Yeah. Basically what it was there was a thing called the Snyder Trophy, which was a biannual international airspeed race, and Britain won it twice, and the idea was if they won the third one they would get to keep the trophy for good. But at this point the government said we're not going to fund this stuff, we need all the money, and she thought that was a huge mistake.
It seems a bit of a, like, this is a crazy wonder weapon idea, it's not going to, like, this is a mad waste of money.
This was in
late 20s, early 30s. Yeah. This was before...
Exactly. And so she said, well, no, that shouldn't be the case. So she funded it. She funded it for it to go ahead. And as a result, Rolls-Royce developed a new engine that became the Spitfire's engine and so on. So it was down to her and making that happen.
Yeah. She was the wizened old Texan of her day, wasn't
she? Yeah, she was. Exactly.
They're wonderful. Let me tell you, if you've got some money, lose some of it with me. It's fine.
We also have a Patreon, just to say.
Damn it.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Okay, it's time for our final fact of the show, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that one of the original names proposed for what we now know as Neanderthals was Homo stupidus.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so this was in the early days when we were finding skulls of what was then thought like, is this a bear? Is this a sort of just, like, no one knew what
this is. It's a plane.
there was a point where we were finding lots of skulls and we didn't quite know what this thing was. It would later turn out to be Neanderthals.
Right.
And when they got to a point where they were thinking, okay, actually, we do have a new, different species of Homo here. We need to give it a name. But by the look of it and by the skeletons that had been found, it looked like a very clumsy, bulky idiot. And so, a very famous scientist at the time, Ernest Haeckel, suggested, why not call it Homo stupidus, to really dig home that this is why this moron is no longer existing on our planet. Now, we now know that this is completely wrong, that Neanderthals were actually very intelligent. They did art. They could sing, perhaps. You know, there's lots of things that we're discovering more and more about them. They used penicillin, even, like an old version of penicillin.
I mean, prehistoric version.
Prehistoric.
yeah.
Not
yeah.
over the counter stuff. These sure. guys. Yeah. But you're a Neanderthal expert, yeah. Ella.
So I have a number of questions. One is...
I feel we're doing this the wrong way around.
Well, no, this is definitely targeted at you three. So when you have the guest on, are the topics always consistently the topics that they are specialists in? And if so, why did I get a Spitfire?
I think we try a bit of inside baseball. We try to do things that our guests are going to know a lot about.
Yeah.
On your Wikipedia page, it says you're an expert in rivets.
Please, nobody edit it. There's already a whole bunch of untruths on that page.
But sometimes a little fact about maybe logistics or military strategy will just slip through.
I wish this is being filmed because your face. Went... Yeah, no. The thing with so taxonomy is the system of naming things in biology, and there's this rule called it's an a priori thing, and what it means is that if we find a fossil today, and we call it something, that is the name it is given if it becomes a species. So if I find a fossil today and I go, oh, it might be Homo sapien or it might be Homo schreiber.
Okay. We already had a Homo stupidus.
Right. Then let's say there's this, but I publish it.
Yeah.
So if I publish in any journal, then later on, if people are still like, no, we don't think that's a separate species. If suddenly two more of them are found that really do look similar and somebody goes, no, actually, we really do think that now needs to be a species. They can't go, well, we want to call it, you know, Homo whatever. No. The a priori rule is very clear. It has to be called that. So luckily, Homo neanderthalensis must have got in there earlier, because otherwise we would be stuck with that bloody name.
Yeah, it was proposed. It was never seriously taken to a board. It was a guy called Dr. William King, who was an Irish geologist, who eventually... was the one who said, let's call it Neanderthal, because it was found, the particular one they were looking at, found in 1856 at the Neander River Valley, and so it was named after
Germany,
the area.
Yeah.
And Thal is valley, isn't it? I didn't know that.
Oh, I didn't
As in
know
Neander,
that.
Neander, Valley, Thal. It was in the Neander Valley.
Wow.
Yeah, that's all.
So the Homo neanderthalensis is what we call it now.
Yeah.
But some people call it Homo sapiens neanderthalensis because it might be a subspecies of Homo sapien. If it was called Homo sapiens stupidus, then that would literally be stupid wise man.
Oh, yeah.
Because sapiens means wise.
Yes.
And that would have been quite a...
Yeah. I don't actually know how sapiens was picked, because it does feel like we've given ourselves the nice...
Aren't we?
Yeah, we're great, but I'm just saying it's
a
bit...
We're the naming committee. Of course we're going to.
Some people said once that the brain is the only thing that named itself.
Yeah.
Which I think is nice. So brain must be a really good word for it.
Yeah. It's actually a rubbish word, isn't it?
Yeah. Your brain would have come up with something better than that.
Yeah.
Idiot.
One of the names that the Neanderthal could have had was Gibraltar Man, Homo Gibraltarus or whatever, the first skulls were found in Gibraltar, but they were found too early. And they were found by, I think, a soldier, and he was a soldier and geologist, and he said, I think this might be something new, but he didn't really get anywhere, you know.
Yeah, I think there was a few that were found technically before, but they just didn't identify that. I think there was one in, I think the Spee one as well, which is Belgium. I think that's also an early one.
Yeah.
Where they just didn't...
Flint was his name, Edmund Flint, which is a nice sort of prehistoric sounding name. Yeah. Or, you know,
like he sounds like he's from the Flintstones.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? And he found it, but again, he didn't get anywhere. And actually, I think the last Neanderthals also lived in Gibraltar.
Well,
yeah.
I disagree with that.
Go on.
Okay. No, I think the team out there really believe that, but I don't think most of the rest of us believe that. Oh, I think we think it's a toss-up. It might have been the Iberian Peninsula, but I just, yeah.
Was it somewhere islandy where things kind of cling on a bit?
Yeah, it was probably just the south, but also we just don't know, actually. The dates are constantly shifting. When I say that, I mean that when the scientists are dating them, they're realising that all the dates we thought we had are kind of not as great, shall we say. There's many question marks about these dates.
I was reading about a Neanderthal site in Croatia called Krapina Cave.
Yeah.
And what I found is that they found coprolites in there. So that suggests that Neanderthals might have actually crapped in a cave.
Do you know what? It would take you lot for me to realise that Krapina, which is an integral part of my research, is actually crap. I had never in all my years realised that before.
That's so good.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I really appreciate it. No, I'm not going to high five you. No.
Sometimes it takes a fool to teach a wise woman.
As stupid as.
Ella, do you know whether or not you're a bit Neanderthal?
Yeah, I got tested.
Yeah.
What's your number?
I don't know. Can't remember.
You can't remember? You study Neanderthals and you couldn't be bothered to...
I can't remember retaining it. It was average-ish. As far as I remember.
2%
is average. 2%.
And you can do that. So the National Geographic Society, they have a genographic project where you do a swab in your mouth and you send it in and then they can give you the results and tell you whether you're not. And then I think we know Ozzy Osbourne is a bit Neanderthal.
Yeah. We mostly are.
Is it... Everyone outside Africa is a couple of percent, and that because early humans left Africa... bred with Neanderthals, those populations spread to like Europe, Asia. But then, so is it called ghost DNA? I love this. Even people in Africa these days have kind of a small fraction of a percent of Neanderthal DNA.
Well, so there's a few things going on there. One is that, it's so everybody outside of sub-Saharan Africa. The Tunisians have got some, you know, the Egyptians have got some. Okay. And what it is Neanderthals were more European Asian species and never went into Africa. So it was that's why sub-Saharans don't really have it.
Right.
The ghost DNA, so this is really cool. So now ancient DNA is so fascinating that they have been able to identify that there are other species out there called Homo God knows what, but they just don't have a single fossil for it. They don't know anything about this, but they know, based on looking at all of our DNA globally, there were other species that we interbred with, and we just don't know. So we know that we interbred with Neanderthals. We know that we interbred with a species called Denisova. And then, in the process of doing all this, they've also come across a few ghost lineages.
That's so cool.
How do you marry it up with the fossils that are out there? Because you're like, I don't know what it looks like.
So do we not name it until we find a fossil?
So in genetics, if it's a ghost lineage, they tend to like give it like population Y or population X or that kind of thing. They don't give it a name because they really don't know.
You gotta give it a cooler name than that, you know?
Well, that's the whole point. It's a standby name, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I see. And they'll come up with a really,
you want to come up
awesome
with the cool name first.
Yeah, you're right.
But imagine if, so you've got Homo naledi, which is a new species that they discovered in South Africa. And that might be the ghost lineage. Huh. But that might be one of them, but we don't know because until we've got DNA, we can't compare the two.
A DNA from a fossil?
Naledi, yeah. You need the DNA. You need DNA from the fossils you've got to be able to compare it to this ghost lineage.
So it might be from Homo
naledi. It might be naledi. We just don't know.
Oh,
it's so cool. So the guy that found naledi, Lee Berger, is like, I reckon it is. Mm. But we're all like, maybe. We don't know, though.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got very excited.
No, it is exciting. It's incredible.
Do you know, is his name Svante Paabo?
Svante Paabo, yeah.
So he's a Swedish DNA expert. And did he start the field of extracting DNA from ancient bones?
He just won a Nobel Prize for it.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, congratulations, Professor Pavlik.
And it was really funny because he won it for medicine, and everybody went, we just had COVID. What? We just had COVID, and you've given it to this guy who's found Neanderthal DNA. Slow clap.
He published this study, and you know, he'd realized that you could extract DNA from old bones, and that's a huge realization. He worked out how to do it as well, and he got letters, lots of letters from men saying, I think I'm Neanderthal, actually. I think I'm... He said, fully or partly Neanderthal.
Fully.
And said, like, offering him samples to analyse for his work.
What kind of samples?
I think spit samples. I think... But there was a really interesting... There's definitely a gender divide here. Because 12 women wrote in to him to say, my husband is definitely... He's a Neanderthal. You can study him if you like. Only 2 men wrote saying the same of their wives. And I don't know if any women wrote in saying, I'm pretty sure I'm a Neanderthal.
Right, okay.
So there's an interesting thing about how we think of Neanderthals today. That's what it tells us about, really.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's actually so true because, sorry, I pointed at you very aggressively then, but...
just for the listeners.
I made a show called Neanderthals for the BBC and PBS, and...
Andy Serkis, who is Gollum in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and a million other things. Like, the guy's got a very impressive resume. And there was this really big discussion because we were like, blatantly, you're going to make the reconstruction is going to be a male. But actually, why are the reconstructions of cave men always men? Like, it doesn't make... Like, think about the Descent of Man image where it's like, you know, from ape to human. Mm. It's always just men. And it's like, well, they definitely didn't do that on their own, right? So it's like, where are the women in this? And we had a really big discussion. And in the end, we did make a man and we called it Ned. But we did make a Nelly, but the Nelly was not of the same quality. Okay, but the animation wasn't... It wasn't Andy Serkis's work. Let's just put it like that.
Was Andy Serkis playing the motion capture Neanderthal?
Yeah, so he brought the Neanderthal to life, basically.
Did he co-host?
There's this scene where I love this scene, it kind of gives me goosebumps when I see it, where he wakes the Neanderthal up from his slumber. So it's an Iraqi Neanderthal and he wakes it up from its slumber. He's like Andy's freaking circus.
Was he both of the male and the female?
No, they literally Nelly was forgotten about.
Nelly.
No. But
I do wish he co-hosted it as the end of the
podcast. That would have been
El Shamahi.
So, do you guys know why Neanderthals have got such a bad rep?
Didn't they find what were effectively, unfortunately, deformed skeletons and so on? And and so we just thought, that must be what they all looked like.
Yeah. So basically, it was an individual, La Chapelle aux Saints. Don't query my French. It was a highly arthritic individual. it was an old man, although I'm pretty sure it was only like 40, but you know, old for the time. But very young for today. And they basically,
I don't like the way you looked at me when you said that.
He was highly arthritic, and there's a number of things going on here. But the guy who did the reconstruction of this fossil basically portrayed it as being like essentially knuckle dragging. Its head's jutting forward, it's, you know, its knees are bent, blah blah blah. And then they obviously realized later on that was completely incorrect, but it was too late. It was like it got out there that this is, and because we were looking for a missing link in inverted commas, right? So it kind of fit the narrative, and it was a new field, right? Reconstructing what somebody looked like from a fossil was such a new field that, you know. And so essentially it's everybody's speculating since as to why he did such a bad job, which is really embarrassing because his legacy, amongst other things, because he's quite a, you know, renowned person, is that he basically did an awful PR job on Neanderthals.
It's amazing. Like, if just, like, for instance, in a million years' time they find humans and they only find my body. I have very bad sinuses, right? They're just going to think all humans had a cold all the time.
That's it.
What happened.
That's completely...
They're going to find Dan's body and think all humans were unbelievably hairy.
I love how you guys don't know how bodies and decomposition works. But sure, hair is going to be found on...
They'll find Andy and they'll be like, well, all humans used to make model aeroplanes.
That's because they'll have found me in my tomb where I've been buried with all my air fixes.
And all your rivets.
Homo riveting. Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found on our Twitter accounts. I'm on at Schreiberland. Andy?
At Spitfire, Spitfire, Spitfire.
Jesus.
James?
At James Harkin.
And Ella?
Ella underscore Alshamahi.
Yep, or you can go to our group account, which is at No Such Thing, or you can go to our website, nosuchthingasafish.com. All of our previous episodes are up there, so do check them out. And Ella does want to give another shout out quickly to Daniel Stone's book, The Food Explorer. It is an amazing book, so do try and track that down. But otherwise, come back next week, because we'll be back with another episode, and we'll see you then. Goodbye.
I've tried every miracle cream out there, and most of them end up in my bathroom graveyard. You know, that shelf of broken promises. But KPS Essentials actually works and keeps working. My skin feels smoother, hydrated, and alive again. Not fake, just healthy. Whatever this Dermanew technology is, my skin's clearly into it. It's like skincare with a PhD. They're clean, small batch, and trusted by doctors and five-star spas, and now by me. Go to kpsessentials.com and take the skin quiz. It'll match your skin to exactly what it needs. Because healthy, happy skin shouldn't be a miracle.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.